Forces converged. The article in Rolling Stone, my live performances, appearances on The Tonight Show, a modestly produced one-man show on the new and experimental network HBO, and intriguing reviews and press made audiences ignite. The confluence that I had doubted would ever happen through auditions for sitcoms was now happening outside of Hollywood's control. My audience was developing more like a rock and roll band's than a comedian's. I was underground and on the road. Outside of the big cities, I was playing concerts seating about 500 people, a small number, but they were avid. Aggressive fans, sometimes wearing arrows through their heads or balloon hats, were gathering outside the stage door after the shows, and I had to have a guard walk me safely to my car. After a show at a college in Boise, Idaho, I said to the two student escorts, "Stand close, I'll sign a few autographs, but we should keep moving toward the car." I pushed open the stage door, a rush of Idaho's silence. Nobody. Nothing but twinkling stars. Idaho hadn't gotten the word yet. The two students looked at me with disgust. Some promoters got on board and booked me into a theater in Dallas. Before the show, I asked one of them, "How many people are out there?"
2,000,
he said.
2,000? How could there be 2,000?
That night I did my usual bit of taking people outside, but it was starting to get dangerous and difficult. First, people were standing in the streets where they could be hit by a car. Second, only a small number of the audience could hear or see me. Could Charlton Heston really have been audible when he was addressing 1,000 extras? Third, it didn't seem as funny or direct with so many people. I reluctantly dropped it from my repertoire. I now had the luxury of performing only one show per night, which meant that after a dozen years of 2, 3, and even 5 shows per day, I no longer had to include a weak bit in order to fill time. I cut lines that I loved but which rarely work, such as, "I think communication is so frustrating." Or, "I'm so depressed today, I just found out this death thing applies to me." And, "I have no fear, no fear at all. I wake up and I have no fear. I go to bed without fear. Fear, 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 fear. Yes, fear is a word that is not in my vocabulary." Or this weird one. "Oh, I just found out I'm vain. I thought that song was about me." I continued doing The Tonight Show and performing in concert. Before a show in Milwaukee, I asked the promoter, "How many are out there?"
3,000.
3,000? It didn't seem possible. I worried about being seen at such distances. This was a small comedy act. For visibility, I bought a white suit to wear on stage. I was conflicted because the white suit had already been used by entertainers, including John Lennon. I was afraid it might seem derivative, but I stayed with it for practical reasons, and it didn't seem to matter to the audience or critics. The suit was made of gabardine, which always stayed fresh and flowed smoothly with my body. It got noticed in the press because it was a 3-piece suit, which appeared to be a symbol of conservatism. But I really wore the vest so my shirt would stay tucked into my pants. How could I look better than they do if my shirt was blousing out between my belt and my suit button? I was now coming up with jokes about the increased size of the house. My opening was the magic dime trick, in which I would claim to change the date of a dime. Then I would ask the back row what they'd paid to get in. They would shout it out, and I would laugh hysterically, implying that they were getting screwed. Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night Live, inquired about my hosting the show. "Yes and yes," I said. I flew to New York a few days early, and Lorne walked me into the busy studio on a Saturday afternoon. Gilda Radner's cheery lilt and Lorraine Newman's alto voice crisscrossed as they rehearsed a sketch. Chevy Chase noodled on a piano in a corner. Danny Aykroyd and John Belushi, one a virtuoso and one a hurricane, energetically entertained each other while the cameras swung around the studio, and the dominant sound was the resonance of Danny's big laugh. Belushi turned out to be the nicest rowdy person I ever met. Both scary and down to earth, he once told me, "I never yell at the staff. Only the department heads." In Lorne's office later that day, the leather-clad Danny Aykroyd told me he'd been up all night riding his motorcycle, and when it stalled at 4 a.m., he had thumbed a ride. When the car got up to speed, the driver pushed him out of the moving vehicle, and he rolled onto the rainy streets of Manhattan. I pictured Danny bouncing down the wet pavement, and then said the only thing that came to mind. I asked him if he wanted to go to Saks and shop for clothes. He said, as friendly as he could,
that's not my thing."
We liked each other, but we were different.
I first appeared on Saturday Night Live in October 1976. I felt powerful butterflies just prior to being introduced, especially when I reminded myself that it was live, and anything that went wrong stayed wrong. But it is possible to will confidence. My consistent performing schedule had kept me sharp. It would have been difficult to blow it. I did 2 monologues straight out of my act, some sketches, including Jeopardy 1999, remember this was 1976, and a spoof commercial where I pitched a dog that was also a watch called Fidoflex. The show turned out well, though I didn't realize how well. The next Monday I had a concert in Madison, Wisconsin. It would be my first show after the Saturday Night Live appearance. How many are out there, I asked. 6,000. 6,000? At least twice the normal. I walked on stage and was greeted with a roar of such intensity that I remember feeling both pleasure and fear. In response to the deafening approval, I was, like an athlete at the college playoffs, flooded with adrenaline. I made quick adjustments for the thundering cheers and the increased audience size. I bore down. My physicality intensified and compressed. Smaller gestures had greater meaning, and my comedy became more potent as I settled deeper into my own body. I opened the show with this line. I have decided to give the greatest performance of my life. Oh, wait, sorry, that's tomorrow night. My fame knocked on my parents' door. They couldn't help hearing about their son. My father, though, was not impressed. After my first appearance on Saturday Night Live, he wrote a bad review of me in his newsletter for the Newport Beach Association of Realtors, of which he was president. His performance did nothing to further his career. Later, shamefaced, my father told me that his best friend had come into the office holding the newsletter, placed it on his desk, and shaken his head sternly, indicating a wordless, "This is wrong." I believe my father didn't like what I was doing in my work and was embarrassed by it. Perhaps he thought his friends were embarrassed by it too, and the review was to indicate that he was not sanctioning this new comedy. Later, he gave an interview in a newspaper, which he said, "I think Saturday Night Live is the most horrible thing on television." I suppressed anything I felt about his comments because I couldn't let him have power over my work. After all, I explained to myself, the whole point of this comedy was to turn off the older crowd while reeling in the young. But as my career progressed, I noticed that my father remained uncomplimentary toward my comedy, and what I did about it still makes sense to me. I never discussed my work with him again. But my mother was aglow. She had a continuing fascination with celebrities, and now she had one of her very own. She was never moved by what I was doing. In an interview, she said, "He writes his own material. I'm always telling him he needs a new writer." But she was very involved with how things were going. She kept up with every little appearance and success and reported anything positive her friends had said to her, though sometimes she couldn't discern the fine line between a compliment and an insult. After I started making films, she once told me, "Oh, my friends went to the movies last weekend, and they couldn't get in anywhere, so they went to see yours, and they loved it." I was a newly minted star when we were driving through Beverly Hills, and she said, "Get out and walk down the street so I can watch people look at you." I gently declined, explaining to her how uncomfortable it would make me feel, but it never sank in. Another time she said, "I was in line at the supermarket yesterday, and when they found out I was your mother..." I kept puzzling over the exact phraseology my proud mama must have used to work her information into normal supermarket discourse. Money trickled her way. I was able to give her a monthly clothes allowance, and she was ecstatic. She became a regular at Neiman Marcus and loved that she was modestly famous as she browsed the racks of her favorite designer, St. John. When our mother died, my sister Melinda had an idea. She suggested our mother be buried on a hillside in a plot overlooking the upscale Fashion Island shopping center in Orange County, and that is exactly what we did. My first album, Let's Get Small, released in 1977, sold 1.5 million copies. The material was so vivid to Bill and me that we naively included bits that were largely visual. The uninitiated heard clanks and spaces that brought forth laughs, and this minus turned into a plus, as the transitions seemed more surreal than they already were. Audiences were intrigued to see live what they could only hear on the album, and the theaters filled. During my third appearance on Saturday Night Live, I incorporated a line from my act, "I'm a wild and crazy guy," into Danny Aykroyd's idea
along with Marilyn Miller and James Downey, about two Czechoslovakian brothers. We caught the public's fancy, which gave me my second ticket into catchphrase heaven. My second album, A Wild and Crazy Guy, released in 1978, was being promoted every time we did the sketch on the show. It sold 2.5 million copies and went to number one on the charts. Well, okay, number two. Promotion was becoming a regular part of the job, and when I did The Tonight Show, it was understood that either I or Johnny would hold up an album for all to see. After A Wild and Crazy Guy blistered the record charts in 1978, I was on the cover of Rolling Stone and Newsweek. I hadn't significantly collaborated with other performers since my days at the Birdcage. My appearances on Saturday Night Live, whether I was dancing with Gilda Radner, clowning with Danny, pitching show ideas with Lorne and the writers, or simply admiring Bill Murray, were community comic efforts that made me feel like I had been dropped off at a playground rather than the office. Watching the gleam in your partner's eye, acting on impulses that had been nurtured over thousands of shows, working with edgy comic actors, some so edgy they died from it, was thrilling. We were all united in one single goal, which was, using the comedian's parlance, to kill. The record sales and the appearances on Saturday Night Live compounded the size of the live audience. "How many tickets sold?" I asked in Toronto. 15,000, they said. In St. Louis, I was told, 22,000. The act was on fire. My set list from the period, now tattered and yellowed, remind me of forgotten routines. I would sing, "I Can See Clearly Now," and walk into the mic. I would juggle kittens, swapping the one real kitten for a stuffed lookalike, and I would stand in spilled water and touch the mic, faking an electric shock, then do it again as though I had enjoyed it. I had a long routine for me, in which I confessed my weird sexual fetish. I like to wear men's underwear. There were more. "I know what you're thinking," I would say conspiratorially. "You're thinking, Steve, how can you be so fucking funny?" In my opening seconds, I would say, "It's great to be here." Then I would move to several other spots on the stage and say, "No, it's great to be here." I would move again. "No, it's great to be here." Shouting to the audience, "Everybody put your hands together." I would put my hands together and hold them there, making only one clap, saying, "Now keep them together." "Hello, Crime Stoppers," and the audience would say, "Hello, Steve." "Let's repeat the Crime Stoppers oath. I promise not to depreciate items carried forward from one tax year as non-depreciable items." I learned in comedy never to alienate the audience. Otherwise, I would be like Dimitri in La Condition Humaine. A lot of people wonder if Steve Martin is my real name. Well, I did change my name for show business. My real name is Gurn Blanston. So please, just call me Gurn. Now, don't ask me why, but this was funny at the time. There was even a Gurn Blanston website, and for a while there was a rock band that used the name. "I'm so mad at my mother. She's 102 years old, and she called me the other day. She wanted to borrow $10 for some food. I said, 'Hey, I work for a living.'" Some nights I would stand on stage and tune my banjo, but my hand would be about a foot away from the tuners, twisting in the air. I would act as though I couldn't figure out why it wouldn't go in tune. And my closer, "Well, we've all had a good time tonight, considering we're all going to die someday." In the late 70s, I continued to tour. My schedule was this. After sleeping all night on a band bus, I would arrive at a hotel around 7 a.m. and collapse in a groggy half-sleep until 4 p.m. Then I would have a room service dinner, and the only thing on the hotel menu that fit my fishitarian diet was breaded fried shrimp with the texture of sandpaper, really just a ketchup delivery system. Following that, I would dumbly watch the 5:30 p.m. airing of The Brady Bunch. This showing, it seemed, was universal. Then I would do the show. We, my roadie Maple and the sound team, were moving with such clockwork that some nights it seemed as though we were rolling down the highway for the next town before the applause had stopped in the arena. 60 cities in 63 days, 72 cities in 80 days, 85 cities in 90 days, the Coliseum in Richfield, Ohio, largest audience in one day, 18,695, the Chicago International Amphitheater, 29,000 people, stealth limousines and subterranean entrances. I played Nassau Coliseum in New York. How many tickets sold? 45,000. I was astonished that popular culture had fixed its attention so intensely on my little act. This lightning strike was happening to me, Stephen Glenn Martin, who had started from zero, from a magic act, from juggling in my backyard, from Disneyland, from the birdcage, and I was now the biggest concert comedian in show business ever. I was elated. My success had outstripped my wildest aspirations. I had hit a gusher, and I stopped checking prices in restaurants, hotels, and clothing stores. I bought my first house, and then I bought my second house, skillfully negotiated by my father. My wisecrack about success was, "We'll offer you $50,000 to go stand over there." "I can't. I'm getting $75,000 to stand right here." I had a line in my act. "I think I'm spending my money wisely. I just bought a $300 pair of socks and a gasoline-powered turtleneck sweater."